Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you by Plexaderm and by our friends at ZipRecruiter. So let's talk about what people in the real world are talking about today. Not necessarily the folks that you, the talking heads that you see from the various coasts, but people, the people who actually determine the outcome of the election. So who better than that? Who better to talk about that than Dave Weigel from the Washington Post, who is a road warrior. You really are a road warrior, aren't you, Dave?
I am. I mean, I always hesitate when people talk about how hard it is. The hardest thing, frankly, is just your friends tend to forget you exist and you stop being invited to things back in D.C. because they're like, well, you're never around.
Okay, well, so this is the question. So you are never around. How many days out of the year are you on the road during a campaign? Or you can break it down by month if you want. No.
I have a calendar in front of me that I don't think you want me to narrate all of, but I'd say easiest way to put it is I'm only in D.C. 3 days a week on average and out the rest of the time. And when I'm in D.C., I really try to maximize what I'm doing, who I'm catching up with. I don't know when I actually relax. That's the second question we'll have, and I can't answer that.
This will amaze you, but I actually do want you to read the calendar. So just tell me what states you've been in the last 30 days.
Okay, so let me open this calendar up. So I've been in D.C. the last couple of days, but on Saturday and Sunday, I was in Colorado. On Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I was in California. On Wednesday, I'm going backwards, I was in Staten Island, New York. Before that, I was in D.C. for a little while, but last Saturday, I was in Texas. Same thing Friday. And the weekend before that, I was in, several days before that. So I was on Texas Friday, the 27th of September. On the 23rd and 24th of September, I was in Iowa, and I'd come there from Louisiana, where I was writing about the governor's race. So that's the last 2 weeks, and that is I get all the time zones, actually, if you count D.C. in there. And that's pretty typical.
Can I ask you a very personal, intimate question then?
Sure, yeah.
How many frequent flyer miles do you have?
I have a lot. On Delta, I have about 880,000. On American, I have about 300,000.
Okay, so you're kind of like the George Clooney character in Up in the Air. Not quite as many miles, but in terms of, like, you live out of a backpack and you're on an airplane all the time.
I think that's a fair way to put it. I actually, there are people who have go bags and things like that. And I always, maybe this is the old, you know, Catholic self-deprecation or something, but there are people who have to travel a lot, and it's because they need to cover the next hurricane or the next war zone. I end up going to, at worst, at the most hardy, a place with a La Quinta Inn, as opposed to like a nice big cushy hotel. So I do travel a lot. I have to work to keep relationships, the friendly relationships, back in D.C. and the part of Up in the Air that resonates with me is, you know, returning to the basically empty home. Mm-hmm. My home is right. The opposite of empty, because I've never thrown out a book and I have them all piled in various parts of the house. But there are times I come back and say, wait, I'm supposed to live here, aren't I? I should probably clean this up.
I mean, you can't even have a cat with that schedule.
Oh, absolutely not. I've had partners who had dogs, and that's nice. But it's gotten to the point where some people have asked me, should we just collaborate? We both travel a lot. They're, you know, platonic friends who say, maybe we should just cut bait here and come up with a way so that there is a dog and we both own it and we trade it off. And I said, that sounds like even more work. And let's wait until there's an election. Maybe we can rearrange our lives.
Yeah. Sort of forget meaningful relationships. I imagine you have a lot of dead plants in your past.
I have not in the past. I have a succulent, like a little cactus that is alive still. That's about it right now.
Okay, and there is no end in sight. This is not going to let up between now and the end of the year. Is there a voice in your head, like your mom, telling you to pace yourself on all of this, or at least make sure you have clean underwear?
Literally, my mom, because my parents had their anniversary this week, and I called them, and that was, I think, in about 30 seconds that subject came up. That I do this too much. I actually, the nice thing about travel is my folks live in Wilmington, Delaware, so I fly back to Philadelphia sometimes, spend time with them, and then I'll pay for my own little train ride back to D.C. So I see them a pretty good amount of time. more than some of my friends. And you realize as you report for years, there are friends you make, good friends that you see either exclusively when you're traveling or more when you're traveling when you're in DC. And these are friends often who live near you. I mean, I have some friends in DC who live in my neighborhood, and the last three or four times I saw them, we were in Iowa together. We were not in Columbia Heights.
But who really needs friends when you have Twitter?
That's true.
Right? You can have these meaningful, immediate relationships on Twitter.
The impression of being happy, of being surrounded by a comfortable life at all times. Or I guess the opposite, because it's mostly people yelling at you.
Okay, so for people who are listening, the theme of this podcast is not how does Dave Weigel always have clean underwear. That is not the theme of the podcast. The theme of this podcast, Dave, is what do you see and hear that we don't hear, back here? Now, I happen to be in Wisconsin, so I am close to crucial Waukesha County. But let's talk about it. So you said you were in Colorado. And I noticed from your newsletter, you had an interesting take. The Colorado family feud. Mm-hmm. And so just talk about this in terms of what you're seeing about, I think the headline was a front runner who's not on board with liberal priorities faces a pack of insurgents. So let's talk about the family feud going on in Colorado. What'd you see there?
Right. So the origin of the story was that I covered John Hickenlooper's campaign for president. It didn't last very long. When it ended, within a week, he was convinced by Democrats to run for Senate in Colorado, and he'd ruled this out several times and pretty passionately. He'd explain why he would not be a good senator, and that's some detail that had been reported already. I mean, I had a lot that didn't make the story, and he admitted he had ruled it out, but then he got leaned on by former governors, the friends who kind of knew his mindset, and they convinced him this is actually a great job for someone like you. So. I was interested in his campaign. I noticed that, like every primary campaign for the Senate this cycle, the front runner is fairly centrist, at least in the modern Democratic Party. I mean, Hickenlooper doesn't support Medicare for all. He doesn't support fracking. He does support limited fracking, where at the moment, one of the front runners for the nomination was that Warren wants to ban it. So I've been really interested in these Senate races where, Doug Jones, Mark Kelly, John Hickenlooper, Kyle Cunningham, Sarah Gideon, these people are not going to agree with Elizabeth Warren if she's the nominee. So the left might win this. Well, if Warren wins the nomination, and let's revisit the podcast in a week or so. Yeah, if she were to win, it would be probably the biggest left-wing triumph since McGovern in 72. At the same time, they would, like the Democrats in 1972, their hope to power would rest a lot of moderates, or a lot of, in some cases, conservatives. So I went there for that. And yeah, it was very stark that there is a dozen candidate field. There's Hickenlooper and 11 candidates. Some are kind of paper candidates who don't actually show up to anything. And some are very credible, but have been washed away by Hickenlooper. One basically accidentally conceded when I was talking to Alice Madden, who was the state house speaker about 10, 12 years ago when Colorado Democrats made this huge comeback, and they've never really gone back all the way since. And she just said, yeah, well, you can't really win under these circumstances, because groups that she thought would endorse her, people she thought would be her allies, weren't. They just either froze or they endorsed Hickenlooper immediately. And that was surprising to her, that she did not see that. She didn't see Hickenlooper coming, because the guy said many times he wasn't going to run. And then Andrew Romanoff, who actually ran as a progressive insurgent against Michael Bennett 10 years ago, he's running for what he says is his last run. And he can't win this nomination if it's splintered between a ton of people. The only polling on the race has found Hickenlooper at about 60%. And yeah, 60% in a 12-week field is a lot. So even if that declines, he could win. And situations like that always make me emphasize, look, that something's happening in the Democratic Party nationally, something's happening in the caucus states and the primaries, but the mission that they have of transforming the party in their own image seems pretty tough. Like, they haven't gotten a lot of momentum in that direction.
Well, this is why this is interesting, this question of who are the Democrats? Yeah. Are they these progressive insurgents that you see on social media all the time? Is AOC the id of the Democratic Party? Or is the Democratic Party, middle class, working class, moderate people who are very, very pragmatic? You may not hear about them. They don't show up in big numbers at the rallies, but that is where the Democratic Party is right now. And this, depending on which channel you turn to, you get different views of, who's the real Democratic Party. So you're describing a situation in Colorado where a very centrist candidate in a state with lots of progressives seems to be doing well.
Yes, and one argument the progressives were making very explicitly, I quoted some of them, is, look, there are not enough Republicans in this state to reelect Cory Gardner, the senator who won in 2014. And a lot of people agree with them. I mean, the state has moved very far left in just 6 years. The statistic they point out is that Gardner, in winning his Senate race, got fewer votes than the Republican who ran for governor last year, and that Republican who ran for governor last year lost by 10 points. So it's a bit, we've seen it happen both directions. If Democrats felt a lot better about, West Virginia 20 years ago than they feel about it now. And so their argument is that, look, there are only so many Senate seats. They're to quote Rob Blagojevich, they're valuable things. And they are trying to convince their neighbors, hey, if we want the country to move to the left, we need to have a beachhead of left-wing candidates and left-wing senators. We need to copy the Tea Party, for lack of a better way to put it. You need to follow the Jim DeMint model, which irritated a lot of Republicans at the time, but clearly did advance a lot of the far right's goals. And the far left has the same plan, but they have a party that is much more given to hand-wringing and to worrying about what other people think. I forget who pointed this out, because I really want to credit them. But somebody noted that you read anonymous sources, one Democratic strategist, one Republican strategist. Most of the time, the Democratic strategists are going anonymous to explain why their party's despairing and they're going to lose and they're going to blow it. And the Republicans are going anonymous to say, like, well, Trump's making a great move, but I can't talk about it. they're overconfident, and Democrats are very underconfident.
So you write about this a lot, though, the underconfidence, the hand-wringing among the Democrats. But isn't that justified? I mean, the conversation we're having about the Democrats having this huge moderate center, and yet, as we were talking today, it looks like Elizabeth Warren is the front runner in this party. So, I mean, isn't it legitimate to wring your hands and go, oh my God, Donald Trump is imploding, he's doing all these things, but if we nominate somebody like Elizabeth Warren, that will scare the bejabbers out of centrist voters in places like Iowa, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, and we really could blow this again.
Yeah, although that's an argument that has been happening with Democrats for 3 years, and the left in a lot of ways has gotten the upper hand. And I mean, there's nobody arguing for, hey, let's run on the Barack Obama 2012 platform. Everyone has moved to the left.
Yep.
And the analysis is, to boil it down, there is a camp that says, look, Hillary lost because there were working class voters who decided the party didn't stand for anything and they stayed home. The other side says, look, Hillary lost because of chicanery at the last minute, and she was on track to have a coalition that won the presidency. I think the left in some ways gets a better handle on the argument, because even if Hillary had gotten 100,000 more votes in the right places, the Democrats were wiped out of power in a lot of the country. At the same time, the left doesn't have the better handle on this, because they tried in 2018 to nominate a bunch of left-wing avatars in swing districts, and they didn't really win. Not many of them won, whereas people like Tony Evers in Wisconsin, who, whatever you think about him, he did not run as Bernie Sanders.
No, nope.
He looks a little bit like him. They had better head of hair, but he's in his generation. But he didn't run as, I'm the guy who's going to get rid of private insurance and replace it with this.
No, he was just the anti Scott. He was the anti Scott Walker. And
yes.
He was bland. He was boring, and he was unthreatening. So he was almost like a generic candidate.
Yes, and I've heard Democratic strategists refer to him and say, look, I mean, that's kind of, they wouldn't say it's the model, but they would hint that a Biden candidacy, an ideal Biden candidacy, is like that, where there's nothing for the swing voter to be truly worried about. They can just say, well, Trump's a little crazy, this seems like a return to normal. And that argument, I don't think, has gotten as much purchase as people expected in this primary. I think it's a function of just Biden being kind of an ineffective front runner, having the traits as a politician that people identified 40 years ago, and Warren being a very good campaigner. I mean, this can happen. I mean, the same thing happened in 2016. Not the exact same thing, but there are Republicans who, on paper, presented a much clearer, just replace what's wrong case. You know, let's run a 2014 style campaign against what is not working with Barack Obama, and they got Trump instead, and it changed the party's coalitions. So that's the argument that's happening. It reminds me a lot of Republican arguments in 2015, except with more panic, because Democrats like to panic.
Yeah, well, and I want to talk about that panic. I also want to talk about your piece, at least in your newsletter, calling Democrats in disarray. And I want to wade into this really messy story involving Elizabeth Warren. But first, before we do that, David, let's have a word from our sponsors. Today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark, BULWARK, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends, and the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit tryplexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's tryplexiderm.com. Okay, we're back with Dave Weigel, road warrior for the Washington Post. One of the debates that every once in a while I hear on cable television, particularly on MSNBC, is this question of, are there swing voters? And there are a lot of progressives out there who say there are no swing voters at all.
Yeah.
There is only the base. And the base needs to be fed red meat. Otherwise, it's going to sulk. It's not going to come out. And we should not worry about these centrist voters who are either, you know, for sure going to vote for us or for sure going to vote for Donald Trump. Now, you're out there in the world. There are swing voters. There are persuadables, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. That has been overdetermined. I think political science and polling and focus groups have found that there are lots of voters who really would like the kind of people that got elected in 2018. The Alyssa Slotkins, the Tony Evers, the Max Roses. I mean, if this was 1920, when the party could just go to a room and say, here's our nominee, they probably would pick somebody who is more appealing to swing voters. And a thing about covering the left is, understandably, they can't take yes for an answer. I mean, if you're an activist, you don't take yes for an answer. You don't say, oh, all right, you passed about 30% of what I want. I'm good. Well, let's shake hands and I'll take the rest of the year off. But the left has been winning a lot of intellectual and policy battles in the party. I mean, it has moved the $15 minimum wage to something that every swing district Democrat basically voted for, and some Republicans. It moved on healthcare. The new centrist position is basically the left wing Sherrod Brown position from 10 years ago. So they've been winning, but they can't say that they can't say they're winning, and they don't trust. They don't trust some of the Democrats in the party to implement the agenda. And I was talking last night with a Democrat in D.C. who had just concluded some polling. I'm not sure if it'll come out, but it was polling on impeachment, which was doing pretty well. Polling on the presidential candidates, who were not doing that great. I mean, they were beating Trump, but they had lots of fall off with swing voters. And the frustration of this person was, you know, if you win by the biggest margin and you have a Democratic president with a Democratic Senate, that matters much more than the individual choices of the candidate. If Elizabeth Warren has an agenda and 49 senators, and if Joe Biden has 10% of that agenda and 51 senators, Biden gets more done, which I think is right in some ways. But the debate about people's instincts and what they would do with executive powers, I think, is really interesting. And that's when the left has been having more than might have been expected during this primary.
Okay, when you were traveling around the country and you're trying to get a flavor of what is the mood of the country, we of course read these top line polls, which I think don't often capture the nuance, the depth of feeling. How do you do that? There are certain reporters who have the reputation for going into that diner in Western Pennsylvania and and finding the hardcore Trump voter. That's almost become a cliche. So I know you're a guy that likes to push against the cliche. So how do you find what people are really thinking? And part of it, I'm asking sort of the Schrodinger's cat, question of, like, is simply, you know, showing up and saying, I'm a reporter for the Washington Post. What do you think? Does that change the reality? And how do you adjust for that? Do you follow what I'm getting at here?
Yeah. And so the point about diners, I make fun of that because I think on the ground voter voice reporting that does not reflect data is a little bit unfair, or it's a little bit, it can be encouraging to one side or the other, but what does it reflect? And so the worry that inspired a lot of the here in Waukesha County, people still love Trump reporting, those stories were inspired by a sense that the media just ignored those voters because the polls said Trump couldn't win. And I think that wasn't really accurate in 2016. I always point back to the work of Tripp Gabriel in the New York Times, Jenna Johnson, the Washington Post, a lot of people in smaller papers. There was a lot of interviewing of Trump supporters. I guess it was more slanted towards who showed up for his rallies, but the president's pretty obsessed with who showed up for his rallies too. And there's a lot of profiling of what people liked about him. There wasn't enough in some area that surprisingly broke to Trump when Democrats didn't see it coming. And I think that has been corrected. There's been really good work on counties that moved his way, especially because the Democrats running for stuff have focused so much on them. I mean, I've been with everyone who's, you know, from people who are way up in the polls like Warren to people who are way down like Michael Bennett, going to places that used to go Democratic to have conversations. I don't think they fix it in that one conversation. But my point is that I try to make the on-the-ground interviewing match what matters at that moment. And sometimes what matters at the moment is who will win the Democratic primary. And that's kind of easier to do on the street because people show up to Democratic events. People have like party loyalists who maybe show up to some things but have checked out. People show up to every single Warren event, or people are just, you know, county party chairs, and you can poll them and say, what are they thinking? That is often not matched with what the polling nationally or the conversation in D.C. was. I mean, in this cycle, I've been pretty bullish on Elizabeth Warren's chances just because I kept going to Iowa, more Iowa than New Hampshire. I kept going to Iowa and finding local Democratic county chairs saying, yeah, you know, there's not a lot of excitement about Joe Biden. When Warren was here, she got a bigger crowd than we expected. And then talking to people at the events, you know, you ask open-ended questions. Or even, you know, you're having a conversation in a restaurant or bar or gas station, and you ask something open-ended, and I was noticing her name and Pete Buttigieg's name come up a lot. And people who were paying attention to this on TV and were generally inclined to vote for a Democrat really liked them. even when they were polling much lower than they are now. And I'd go to some event for another candidate, and people were saying, oh, I love Elizabeth Warren, or I love Pete Buttigieg, but I'm not sure they can win. The lesson I took was, okay, if there's any change in who people think can win, then there's a lot of opportunity for these candidates. The other thing I found a lot was people who had voted for Bernie Sanders last time, but were not at all interested this time. Even if they show up to a rally, they were kind of undecided and, we'll see how things go. I'm not sure what my options are. So that colored my sense of the primary. And it's different than going and saying, what's the person who doesn't vote?
Right.
Believe. Yeah.
Well, you see, Iowa, obviously, because it is a hardcore voting state because of the caucuses, you know, that kind of reporting obviously is going to reflect, you know, something important. You know, talking to the chairman, you know, leaving Iowa aside, though, isn't there something slightly artificial and skewed by talking to people who show up at rallies or show up at events? Because let's just say that we know the kind of people that show up at meetings. And they're not necessarily—they're not necessarily representative cross section of the electorate. They often tend to be the, you know, usual suspects, and that's always thought was bizarre the way people would interview people who showed up at a Trump rally. What do you think they're going to say? Who do you think they are? As a way of gauging public opinion. So in Iowa, I think that works because the people who show up at these events are the people who are going to show up at the caucus. So there is a 1-to-1 there. But outside of there, do we really get what the, and I'm sorry to throw this out because it seems so hackneyed, but the silent, disengaged majority is thinking at any given moment?
No, you don't. That's a good point. I mean, the point you made about Iowa was one I was about to make, was that the caucuses are going to be determined by, if it's a huge turnout, like 350,000 Democrats. And Elizabeth Warren personally will have taken a photo, I don't know, with 10% of them by the end of the caucuses. So this is a smaller pool. And while most people are never going to go to a political rally, like most humans will probably not show up at a political rally in their lives. The ones in Iowa who are likely to caucus are pretty active. They do take it seriously. They show up. So the conversation with voters there, I think, have a utility. I kind of went into the tangent because I think it is important for the election. Finding the voters who are totally disengaged really is more exploratory. It's something I, as kind of a 3-day-a-week newsletter writer, don't get to do as much as I'd like. I did a little bit last week in LA because I was talking to some homeless people around an event, but some people who were homeless in Los Angeles and had gotten housing since then, not at all reached out to by a campaign and heard more unvarnished thoughts. But that's the sort of thing. There are reporters, again, I mentioned a couple like Jenna Johnson, who will go to a place for a week and, you know, breathe in the same air and go to places and talk to people at places where they have some free time, but they're never going to be engaged with politics, like a yoga studio or like a car detailing place where they're waiting for something. Despite the life I've chosen, I'm a little more introverted than some people. I don't love to say, hey, you know, everyone loves in 2019 politics. Talk to me about it. But it is.
That's an interesting comment, by the way, that you are an introvert. That I actually would not have guessed, given what you do. That must make it very hard.
Well, I've met extroverts who just need to be physically out there with people all the time. And I get my work done, and then I go home and read something, and I've always been that way. So the reporters, but sometimes you get a real charge from going out and talking to people that you never would have met otherwise, and I can get into that groove. I just think in general, I end up, and anyone who's writing about who will win the primary ends up talking to people who vote all the time. And, you know, about 45% of Americans don't vote at all for various reasons. So it's something I think about a lot, is once we get into the general election, I want to keep doing, I'm going to be doing what I'm doing, but I want to think of how to get the voices of people who are much more, I mean, converting a swing voter is one thing. If you can pull somebody who doesn't vote into the election, that's much more valuable. That's something that Barack Obama did very successfully. Trump did, you know, less successfully enough to get elected.
Are you finding that people are more clued in than usual? I mean, we talk about the disconnected voter. I just get the sense in the casual conversations that I have, and I have many fewer than you do, that people have just a tremendous amount of information. Much of it may be wrong, much of it may be skewed, but that there is a level of inundation with politics that would have been unthinkable, say, back in the 1990s.
There is, I think, and I've heard some Democrats even pitch voters on, if I'm elected, you're not going to have to think about this as much, which is the Michael Bennett pitch.
Yeah, which I love.
In a while is, there'll be weeks you don't have to think about me. The Bernie Sanders pitch is more, we need a permanent political revolution. We need constant mobilization. We need constant political rallies. And I think Democratic voters, many of them have found that to be kind of an exhausting pitch. This is a reason I think done well is she has, for a couple months, pretty undeterred, had a Goldilocks position where she has not been around as long as some people. She's not as radical as Sanders. Her approach is not as... it's actually, for all the reputation she had as an academic, her approach is a lot kind of friendlier than I think. Even the way I boil it down is, when they talk about the wealthy, Sanders talks about how billionaires shouldn't exist, and Warren will say, oh, if you made it good, you got to pitch in 2 cents. And there's a lot in that. I mean, it's a statement that means a lot more, but she frames it as, look, the country's going to be the same. You're not going to be on fire all the time. But we have obviously let things go too far in this one direction, which has turned out to be the sweet spot pitch, even if she's not the ideal candidate to make it for some people.
Okay, let's talk about this messy story, because I have to admit I'm having a hard time getting my head around it. It is the story that you've written about. She tells this story, you know, in her first political memoir about how she stopped, you know, teaching special needs kids, and she wrote, this was back in 2014, not that long ago, by the end of the school year, I was pretty obviously pregnant. The principal did what I think a lot of principals did back then. Wish me good luck, did not ask me back the next school year, and hired someone else for the job. Now, she's been telling that story pretty consistently. She loved the job. She was pregnant. She basically got fired for it. And as you describe it, it's kind of a foundational story for Warren. And now there are people who are really questioning that story, and people have dug up this speech in which she basically described it very, very differently, as making it much more, you know, volunteer. She said, I did it for a year, and then that summer I didn't have the education courses, so I was on an emergency certificate and blah, 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 blah. So for a while, that looked like it was catching fire. And then the Free Beacon came out with more information. There's been a tremendous pushback from folks who say, no, she was probably telling the truth. Where do you come down? What do you make of this, and how much of a problem is this going to be for her?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it'd be a problem at all, but for the, you know, the foundational mistake of her career, which was claiming to have been Native American for a couple decades. So there's that. And she had compartmentalized that as she made this mistake, and it is in the past. She has taken the DNA test, even that Native Americans didn't want, but that President Trump challenged her on. And I think she'd benefited with Democratic primary voters, because there was a sense that he had thrown her worst at her. And Trump has even said sometimes, I used this too early. So the reason this was a question at all was that, oh, okay, well, she's catching on. This is the period when we start to dig into some of these biographies or anything in biography that has holes in it. And without getting too much in the weeds, this began because Megan Day, a writer for Jacobin, the socialist magazine, she was researching Warren's teaching career, making the point that if somebody's life goal was to be a teacher, and if you listen to these Warren speeches, she kind of really soups it up. She remembers the faces of the kids, and she knew what she wanted to do since she was 4 years old, et cetera, et cetera. Then why did she only do it for a year? And once she got pregnant, not try to do it again. She went to law school and she became an academic. And so people on Twitter, where this first happened, saw Megan Day tweeting that 2007 interview. And Megan's only point was, she's saying this didn't work out for her and she took the law instead. Why does she keep saying she's a public school teacher? What Megan didn't care about was the pregnancy thing. I think because people don't doubt that they often get passed over or not hired or asked to leave if they get pregnant. And so this happened in 1971. The Supreme Court didn't even weigh in on the policy for 7 years later. So once it became a question of did she really not get asked back because she was pregnant? It's become either you trust her or you don't. I think almost universally Democrats trust her because you can see on Twitter and social media women who say, why is a woman who's 70 being attacked for this? Clearly that happened in the 70s. And you see Republicans say, well, there's a document that says otherwise. So, and I should say, the document says, despite your work, I didn't do a great job explaining this. The original Jacobin story was, in this one interview, she didn't really say she was let go because she was pregnant. The document that the Free Beacon found says that she was hired back for another year, so she did have the qualifications. But then she tendered her resignation, quote unquote, 2 months later. That actually fits with Warren's timeline. So it's now almost a he said, she said, because.
So at the moment, it's basically a wash. So it's
at the moment, it's a wash. But there's no one who's come out and said, oh, yes, I worked with Elizabeth Warren and she's lying. She was totally hired back. People have come out to say, oh, I was teaching around the same time at the same school. And yeah, that's basically what happened. The way this reporting works, let's say you're writing a biography of Warren, which I don't have the time to, you would get the documents and then you interview people around it, because it's just true often that a form will say somebody resigned when we all know that they were sacked for some reason. I mean, that just happens. It's documents say one thing, but how many times has somebody quote unquote resigned from the Trump administration when we know they were fired?
Well, you know, and the problem is that whatever turns out to be the factual basis of this story, that by the middle of next year, if she's the nominee, you know, Donald Trump will be spending hundreds of millions of dollars talking about, you know, lying Elizabeth Warren, right? Just like he'll be, you know, talking about crooked Joe Biden. So let's talk about Joe Biden for a moment. So you talk to Democrats all the time. What is your sense? How much has he been hurt by the events of the last couple of weeks? The whole Ukraine Hunter Biden thing, the fact that he's now lost that sort of glow of inevitability. He's fallen behind Elizabeth Warren in the average of the polls. Are people starting to? Are you sensing any erosion? Because I'm looking at some of these polls, and the polls would continue to show that he's got kind of surprising resilience, more resilience than the conventional wisdom gives him credit for. So, what do you think?
Well, this is much simpler question than stuff about documents in the 1970s. So it matters that Biden was never a terribly strong front runner. He was a front runner. So until yesterday, as we're talking, it's Wednesday. And so until October 8th, literally no poll had ever shown him behind. Even when the Bernie Sanders folks were frustrated, the media never called Bernie the front runner. The media didn't do that because in polling before Biden announced, he was still ahead. But he was never commandingly ahead. He was ahead by at most, you know, 15 points over the field. That's not Hillary Clinton above 40, 50 points over the field. And so this Trump attack on him was telegraphed months ago. I mean, Rudy Giuliani was on Fox saying that they were going to look at Hunter Biden a long time ago. They knew it was coming. And when this particular story broke out, Biden was, you know, single digits ahead of the field. But a lot of Democrats had already seen debates and had worries about whether he should be the front runner. So it's one of the worst situations for this to happen in. If he was Hillary Clinton, if he was 40 points ahead and every Democrat said they're going to be our nominee, I think you would see a bit more rallying around the candidate, you know, like encircling Biden and protecting him. Instead, you have a situation where, you know, there are still 17 Democrats running against the guy. They are not by any means rooting for Trump to be successful if he's smearing him. But they are also telling Democrats, look, there's an option. If you're worried about a Joe Biden who's been kind of middling in the debates and hasn't gotten big crowds and hasn't gotten a lot of money, you have an off-ramp. You have a lot of options here. And for Biden himself, he responded, I think, slower to this than Warren did to the questions about her teaching. I mean, Warren I know a little bit about how both respond to it. Warren knew this was coming, or the campaign knew this was coming, for a couple weeks. They got the documents. They didn't. I think the one mistake they think they made is that she could have gotten out earlier with the teaching form. And had she introduced the form and said, this is how they used to do it in those days, it'd be a whole different story. But they basically dealt with it in 72 hours, whereas Biden has gone back and forth with Trump, has refused to discuss the Hunter Biden story at all. There are Democrats who think it's not great if you're running in a general election with somebody who has family members who got a little bit richer because their dad was the vice president. So he's not convinced Democrats. He already was not convincing Democrats that he was the best nominee like he had been. And then in the last 2 weeks, he hasn't been convincing them that he will be more like Barack Obama than John Kerry, you know, that he will parry attacks and get people to his side rather than say, I'm above this and waiting for it to metastasize. We've already seen it in polling. The Post had some polling this week. Quinnipiac had some polling where already about 38% of people say there probably are questions about Joe Biden and his ethics, which was not ever something that came up around by when he was vetted for vice president or when he was being pushed to run in 2016, right? So he already, I guess, I wouldn't say prove that he's vulnerable. He already showed how he responds to a Trump blitzkrieg, and the answer is not that great.
Not well. So you mentioned that there were off-ramps for centrist voters. What are they, really, realistically? Because it sort of feels if Bernie's health takes him out, then Warren owns that lane. This takes Biden out, and it's basically a coronation for Warren because there's just no other centrist who just seems to have the juice. So you disagree with that?
Well, that's the frustration. So there is a pack of Democrats who are at various levels in national polling, but all have raised some money. They've all raised, I'd say, we can say more than Rick Santorum had raised at this point 8 years ago, right? And they are Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, I should say first among them, Pete Buttigieg, then those two, then even Steve Bullock and Michael Bennett, to a smaller extent, Beto O'Rourke. There are candidates who do not have as far left positions as the rest of the field. Kamala Harris is in the current iteration of what she's running on. I think she's positioned herself the same way. And the argument they're making to donors is, look, Joe Biden is not a good candidate. You have worries of you obviously are worried about Bernie Sanders being the nominee. You have some worries about Warren. I'm running on the agenda that could win the election. I don't come with Biden's vulnerabilities. And Booker, I think, has been in a pretty good position to make that argument, as has Buttigieg, for the simple reason that they perform really well in debates and televised events. I mean, that is a lot of Buttigieg's argument to elite Democrats is, can you imagine me with my charisma and command of the English language going up against Trump? I mean, he didn't say it that way, but he is a very adroit speaker. He is good at that, and that matters to some Democrats. Same thing with Cory Booker. That is where Kamala Harris started to rise, and that's where she fell when she fumbled in the second debate. But the first debate, it wasn't that she hit every single mark of a candidate that Democrats used to support. It was, oh, okay, this is somebody with charisma who we can imagine beating Trump in a debate. And so there's a pack of about half a dozen Democrats who are waiting and waiting and waiting for Biden supporters to decide he's just not that great at this and to move on. And look, that's happened in primaries before. You go back to polling in 2008. This was a horse race between Rudy Giuliani and Fred Thompson because there was so much Republican worry about, so much Republican worry about John McCain. You look back to 2012, that you did have Rick Santorum still has a tough path to win the nomination, but you did have a situation where there's a front runner that the base is not entirely thrilled with. And you have, I think, no offense to Newt Gingrich and Rick Perry in that campaign, but, you know, Cory Booker and Pete Buttigieg have actually been raising credible.
Much more plausible. Yeah, much more plausible. Yeah. I mean, and Buttigieg's money makes him plausible. So I don't think it's been months since I've asked this question. Do you think in 2008, we had the test, would America ever elect an African-American? You know, in 2016, it was, would America elect a woman? It seems like a much tougher question, and I don't want to gloss over it. Is America ready to elect a gay man president?
That's a great question. Not before now. I think there would be no Buttigieg conversation in 2004, obviously. I think quite frankly, a problem Buttigieg has had in with black voters and the campaign, mm-hmm. there's no way to get them to answer this, but it's what I found. Black voters are the most conservative part of the Democratic coalition in terms of in ideology, in social, on social issues. That has always been the case. I think it is an interesting bend of history that Barack Obama was president. Barack Obama personally was able to move a lot of black opinion towards gay marriage. I mean, he endorsed it and it became okay. But still, it's not just that there's some conservative opposition to that among black voters. It is that black voters are among the most interested in electability. And if your friend group says, I'm not sure about this guy, then you think somebody's less electable. So if there's a gay candidate and you have any friends who would say, well, I'm a Democrat, but come on, I'm not going to vote for him. I think that has been a huge problem for him in trying to break out anywhere but Iowa and New Hampshire. I think if he became the nominee, he could get past some of that. I think the voters who did not like Hillary Clinton, white Midwestern voters who were, I'd say 10%, that chunk that moved over, I think they would listen to him. I mean, look, you're in Wisconsin. They've been perfectly happy to elect Tammy Baldwin twice. She's run way ahead of, never been an issue. So I think it'd be a bigger issue at this scale. I think it would be interesting what it does to turn out in some more conservative parts of the Democratic base. I mean, Latinos and black voters have been among the last people to come on board with gay rights. I think we're all talking about an electoral map where the president's at 41% approval, where he keeps talking about states he can't win, like Oregon. I think any Democrat has a good chance. I think he has vulnerabilities more than Warren, who's a bit more left-wing than him, would, and more than someone like than Amy Klobuchar would. For whatever reason, Democrats have just not been convinced by her electability pitch.
Why is that? Because I think she's got a great electability pitch. Is it though that she's just too Midwestern boring? I say that as a Wisconsinite, so.
Yeah, she's not boring at all. She really is. She has a very dry sense of humor. She's very self-deprecating. She's done very well in these forums, but I think Warren benefited. Warren has been underrated, I believe, largely because she never ran for anything until she was 60. She developed a way of talking about issues that does not sound political. And I think she's just been a better candidate than people expected. I don't see it as a patch on Klobuchar or Booker. The other is that they have not caught on. I think in talking to these campaigns early on, a lot of them just assumed, well, Warren's kind of out of the game because she had that mistake with the Native American thing and she seems too left wing. So assume she gets 6% and then we'll build our own campaigns. They've been surprised by how many moderate Democrats, especially women, have come to see Warren as a very acceptable candidate. So, and it's, I mean, Klobuchar is not in the position. She's more in the position of like a Marco Rubio or a, I'm trying to think, there's too many for 2016. One of the kind of good replacement level Republican senators or governors who seems like they could win the election, but it's just not firing people up the same way. And yeah, so no yeah, one rules right. out that she could. She's been doing very well in Iowa, but you know, they need some of these Democrats to change their minds.
Dave Weigel, thanks for spending so much time with us today in your brief visit home. So we appreciate this very much.
This is a whole week. I mean, I not that my house is getting cleaner. For some reason, that when you stare at the mess in your house, it doesn't clean itself. I know no one told me this until it was too late.
I know.
But thanks for being.
Yeah. don't get cocky. Don't buy a cat. That's all I can say. So thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by Plexaderm and by our friends at ZipRecruiter. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.